Welcome to the Nightbird Radio Podcast. I'm Timothy Saylor, and I'm going to be your host this evening as we sound out the subconscious, navigate the nocturnal, and explore the farthest reaches of our experience. Coming at you from the back of an 86 Dodge Ram van on the rolling foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in the great forest, deep in the heart of the Kali Yuga. This is Radio for the Hauntological Turn. And welcome back, Nightbirds. It's great to have you back, and it's great to be back. This week, I'm joined by Janie Roberts. Janie is an educator, an equine-assisted learning facilitator, and a student and practitioner of various folk magical currents. Janie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing so well. I love this intro. It's such a good intro.
Thank you so much.
It reminds me of... Are you familiar with Professor Charles Porterfield?
No, actually, but tell
me. Okay, so he has a radio show, and he also has an introduction that's really similar. It has the same vibes, and he says, deep in the heart of Texas.
No, yeah. He doesn't. Really? That's wild.
It's on. I think it's on Lucky Mojo. Lucky Mojo Radio or something.
I'll keep
expecting to hear his voice come in and be like, I'm Professor Charles Porterfield.
You know what?
Voodoo is my business.
I better get him on. See if I can get him on here.
Absolutely. He's incredible. He's really amazing. Yeah.
I love the hoodoo stuff too, because I think I don't know if it was just learning magic in the South. And that's kind of like the current that's around, and it's like flowing through everything, you know? But mm-hmm. that was like one of, you know, the first kind of modalities that I really like looked into, you know? And I find that I've talked about this with David Payne the other week, but I find that like for some reason, the Norse gods and goddesses like really dig that kind of stuff. And there does seem to be like a lot of like through lines with that and trolldom, mm-hmm. like that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The folk magic of the people, right? And using what works. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, and it's really interesting. Yeah.
So Janie, I want to ask you a question. What were you afraid of as a child?
Oh my gosh, this is so funny because you're talking about, okay, this is the only thing that comes to mind, which is really funny. And we're talking about Professor Porterfield, and I took a couple of his classes online yesterday with my partner he was at the Salem Witchcraft Fest.
Oh, nice.
And he was talking about hoodoo, and he was talking about, you know, different things that were pulled from, of course, like the root and the basis of hoodoo conjure root work is the African-American traditions and the traditions that come from Africa, and then Native American traditions. And then it's like of the European stuff, right? Of the oppressors side of things, the things that were brought into hoodoo were actually oftentimes what were the things that the masters were afraid of, right? Like what were the things that the people who ran the show would be afraid of? So in African traditions, you don't have black spectral dogs. It's just not there. There might be some, he was saying, like, there might be some jackal stuff in there somewhere. But in Southern conjure, the black dogs, it's a thing, and it's scary, right? And that actually comes from European, like Celtic traditions. There's a lot of stuff about black scary dogs. And my grandma from Mississippi used to tell me this story, and I don't remember anything about the story other than there was a black dog walking down the road, and this black dog is coming closer, and it's dark and it's nighttime, and he keeps coming closer, and he's walking along the road, and everybody's feeling really afraid, and then he's coming closer, and he's coming closer. Long dramatic pause.
Good stuff.
And that was the story. And yeah, it was like, I have just been thinking about that. Like, what were you afraid of? Oh, well, I was actually afraid of this, and it has a really interesting place in Southern culture. Having grown up, I grew up in South Carolina, and I know you're in Georgia and have family from Mississippi and Alabama. So, yeah.
I think it's an interesting question, especially for us practitioners, because I think a lot of the things that I was afraid of, I have come into a different relationship to, and that they've become, it's almost become friendly, right?
I mean, absolutely. This is like, this would be huge for me personally, is like coming into that relationship with the, with an animal, right? With like a wily animal, a wild animal, a dark animal, and being someone who works with animals, and particularly works with social mammals, right? Like dogs, like horses, like, and coming into relationship also with the fact that humans are predators, right? Like our eyes are on the front of our heads for a reason. And I think the word predator, of course, tends to have negative connotations, but there are aspects of just being human and the skills that we innately have that aren't necessarily, they don't fit into the box of like the right, wrong aspect of what we sometimes project onto animals that hunt and kill other animals for food.
Right. It's cool that you bring up black dog too, because, you know, I'm a big fan of Hecate, and you know, she's all in that. And interesting, when you talk about predators, you know, when I started, so I started working with her through Jack Grail's Hecateon. And I'll tell you what, I was driving a truck at the time, and I was driving across country a lot. So I was seeing a lot of, you know, I had a lot of time to look at the sides of the road and what animals were hanging out, right? And I saw a lot of like, of raptors swooping down on prey, striking prey. And it was at the same time, you know, when I had started this work, and I actually went to him and asked him about it. And he was like, yeah, that's pretty common actually. And I just remember this feeling of like, there's something about like a goddess like that, that's like, it invokes a more nuanced vision of what it means to be preyed on. Cause I was like, oh, I like want to be preyed upon. You know what I mean? In this context, like strike me, you know? I don't know. It just, and when you're talking about predators, it made me think of that. Like, you know, we have this kind of a connotation that we put on it where it's like bad and good, but in the natural world, it's like, that's someone else getting a meal. And also, you know, when a spirit makes a meal of a person, sometimes they're eating away the things that no longer serve us, so that we can blossom into what we're supposed to be.
Right. Yeah.
I like thinking about that kind of stuff. Well, cool. So like, what, when did you first start riding horses?
Very, very young. I don't even remember. I was probably on a horse before my memories started to register. So my whole life, my dad is the parent that got both myself and my older sister into horses, and she's 7 years older than me, so she was already like into the horse stuff when I was born. So they've kind of been with me my whole life, and I really had a great privilege of being raised outside, and my grandmother lived with me during my childhood as well, and she was always like out in the garden planting flowers. And so my whole life was just kind of outside with animals, with my grandma in the garden. And I think that that kind of shaped me and shaped this, or it really like became a gift and a skill to be able to tune into animals and just be immersed in that world, which I think is something that maybe not a lot of kids from, you know, I'm millennial generation, like from then onward, like so much more of life became boxed in and through screens. And yeah, so since I can remember, they've been with me for a long time. Young adulthood, not so much, only in the past 6 years when I adopted my first Mustang Rogue, did they really become a focus again, mainly because horse life is really expensive and it isn't necessarily accessible to those of us that might be, you know, just like struggling to make ends meet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's tough. So I had a couple experiences with horses that were like, I consider to be like very important kind of points in my life, but I didn't get the opportunity to ride them all the time. Right. Cause I was kind of in that situation that you're talking about where it's like, you know, it's expensive and we, you know, just weren't able to do something like that. But I was able to, on a couple different trips and a couple different times at like friends' land, was able to ride horses. And I remember when I was in like high school, the first time like riding a horse and going, I don't know like what the names for all the speeds are, but I imagine we were like something close to galloping, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling of like synergy between you and the animal, but it also feels like there's nothing, I can't even describe it, right? Like there's nothing like that. I felt like I don't know. I just felt like I was elevated to something more than I was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm sure you can, relate.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's yeah. To me, it's one of the, it's such an empowering feeling. And then there is that
empowering that, is a good way to put it.
Yeah. Like connection too. It's not just like it's empowering, and also it can be really scary because like in a sense you're just like letting this 1,000-pound animal have control at a very high speed, right?
Yeah.
Like so
there's a surrender yeah. aspect.
Totally.
So I like the idea of, so like this is cool because this actually brings about a really interesting paradox in the point in which surrender can be empowering, because
mm-hmm.
I think that happens in other ways, especially, you know, in the spiritual realms, you know, like if I surrender to a deity, I can often become empowered because mm-hmm. I've kind of set aside my little designs for what I think should be going on. And I'm able to gain access to like a much higher view of like what could be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that it's sort of like that, right? But it's cool because it's like, it's more than that because it's like two bodies trusting one another in a way that's just, I don't feel like I hadn't experienced that before. You know what I mean? And so when I did it, it was just like transformative. I actually fell off once too, going pretty fast, and took a nice spill. Like, there's actually a part of my back that's still like, I can't feel it.
Yeah.
Like
I have some interesting back stuff going from falling
yeah.
off horse.
Yeah. Tell yep. me about it. What happened the first time you fell off a horse? What was that like?
What was the first time?
If you can remember, I'm sure it's happened, you know, a couple times.
I know my sister's horse got stung by a bee once. And then I knew like it was always like my sister and I would get into trouble together. And my dad had a horse that was a rescue horse that like my sister and my dad would get thrown off a lot for different reasons, but it tended to be that this horse Sam would like babysit me, but we would end up in situations that were beyond our control. And then I would go flying off. So yeah, a dog chasing the horse one time. So there goes the dog, that dog fear again, right? Just
Okay.
flying off. There were a lot of falling off horses. And I think in my early 20s, I worked with this woman. It was when I first started working with wild horses, and we were attempting to start a Mustang under saddle, and neither of us really knew what we were doing. And we kind of put ourselves into a dangerous situation, and the Mustang, it was like his first ride ever. And he took off with me, and my foot got stuck in the stirrup, and there was no way like I could stop him. So he was just bucking, and I had to like reach down before I decided to attempt a controlled fall. I had to like stay on and reach down to get my foot loose. Otherwise I would have been dragged, which would have been way worse. And so, yeah, I got my foot loose, fell off, and like definitely kind of did something wonky. It tends to be that like the left side of my body is always where I would take the fall, because you get on and off of a horse on the left side. So it's always like, you know, it's gonna happen. So you kind of have to just go. So it would always be like on that side I was used to getting on and off of. So yeah, I'm a little maybe uneven as a result.
So tell me about Wild Horse Circle.
So Wild Horse Circle, it's a project that I started right after the pandemic-ish to get people together. And I really just felt like sharing the medicine of the horses out in the field. And so the horses are loose. We gather in a circle. At times there's been things like sound bowls or different meditations. Sometimes I co-facilitate with people, but really it's a practice of deep listening out in nature with the herd. And I say the herd, right? Like a collection of horses. That herd has kind of shifted and changed over time because I board my horse at different facilities. So I don't own a ton of horses. I wish I did, but some of the horses you see in my videos are other folks' horses. But so going out with the herd and really tapping into and paying attention to what's happening in the natural world. And horses, because they are herd mammals, they're prey mammals, they're incredibly sensitive to what's going on around them. And they tend to respond as well, like not just to one another, but to the people that are in the field as well, whether that's up close or from afar. And they tend to actually like regulate the energy. And you can see things happening in Circle, for example. We'll share like what's going on, just like a check-in, how people's day was and how they're feeling emotionally. And horses are really incredible somatic lie detectors. So if you're like, you come and you're really stressed out and you're really angry, but you say you're okay, the horse might actually reflect some sort of like frustration or tension in their body if they're close to you. But if you're, you know, and this is just an example, if you're like really honest, like, oh, I'm having a shitty day, I don't actually want to be here, I'm feeling kind of frustrated, you might actually see a horse give a release, right? It's like the letting go and finding congruence in the herd, because congruence is what prey animals in a herd are looking for. There might be something to keep our eyes on, right? If one of our herd members is frustrated or stressed out, do I need to be looking for a predator in the environment, right? But if they're able to let that go and express that, then there can be co-regulation in the herd. So that's like an example of the types of things that happen and we look for. And then you know, then comes in the more magical, mystical, mythical, enchanted things that might happen, which I'm sure you're familiar with, those types of synchronistic happenings.
Oh yeah,
that
totally.
Sometimes happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it when they happen. any examples off the top of your head of those sorts of things happening?
You know, I think, well, Well, and I don't know if this is really that. There was a really intense wildfire that broke out during one of, like, right before one of the horse circles, and we could see it in the distance. And when everyone arrived, it was like all of the participants were upset, and they were getting phone calls of people that were having to evacuate that area because sometimes we get fires out here in Colorado. And so it was like we kind of went into this space being a little dysregulated. And so something magical that happened is that we sat in the circle, and the entire herd of horses went from one end of the field, and they like stood in a line between us and the wildfire. And it was like, yeah, so like things like that. And then
that's really cool.
Yeah, it was, we were just like, okay, there, you know, at least like it's that symbolic, like, oh, they're here, they're co-regulating with us, and they're kind of like shielding and guarding us from that intensity that's happening over there. So things like that, things like, you know, I will say everyone's different. So everyone comes to these circles maybe with different perspectives and worldviews. And so one person's synchronicity could be another person's, like, you know, chicken shitting on the ground, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Like for me, this stuff happens to me so commonly that I'm like, this has become normal. I'm not really sure if this is normal anymore. So I'm just going to like maybe not talk about it to everyone I meet. You know what I mean? Like totally. Maybe practice some discernment there. But like, yeah, I love it. That's the kind of stuff that I live for. So what kind of, maybe what are some examples of like some healing that you've seen take place with the help of the, like the relationship between these people and these animals?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things do people come to the circle? What do they bring to the circle? You know what I mean? Like, what do they bring to the circle to be healed or to be expressed or what have you?
I think, you know, honestly, some of the most simple yet profound things could be just like, oftentimes people have had negative experiences with horses, right? Like they've fallen off, or like a horse did something and it scared them, and then they were never around them again. So oftentimes if people show up and they're facing the fear of being around these large intimidating animals, and if they have, you know, it's like having a positive experience, and sometimes it is at a distance as well, can really like rewrite and restory that relationship. And a lot of the work that I do is on the ground with the horses. So not really working towards riding a horse, right? What does it mean to have a relationship with a horse on the ground where riding isn't the goal? And that can be, that actually can be a channel towards really beautiful healing for people that do have a lot of horse experience, where it's like, well, the horse is an animal that I use to accomplish XYZ goal in riding, right? Whether that be like, we're going to go jump over the fence, or we're going to do barrel racing. It's like, well, hold on. What if we had a relationship with the horse that was just as synced as when one is riding? And what if that translated to the saddle, and that actually like created more communication and more softness and gentleness and space for the horse to exist as a horse, right? Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, being more like eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Instead of this kind of almost hierarchical, like I'm on top, you're below.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, so I went through a little phase and people were super into this, but I stepped away for my own personal reasons, which I'll share. But my friend is a systemic and family constellations therapy facilitator, and we both work with horses. And we started doing these family constellations sessions in the presence of horses. And family constellations, it's a bit of a psychological model that historically was borrowed from the Zulu Nation, which the Zulu practiced this type of community healing through ancestral work, where basically the community would come together to solve issues within the tribe. And that model was kind of borrowed, air quotes, right, taken by some Western psychologists. And then it became this modality of more psychological healing, where you work together. There's a client, there's a facilitator, and then there are people that stand in as representatives for the client's family. And really profound healing happened and happens when you have humans and horses working together, really in any type of work like this. So seeing that was, there were a lot of like incredibly transformative moments for me personally, because my personal perspective is a little bit more spirit based, and because this kind of like animistic worldview of everything having a spirit and working with ancestors, I found it to be a little problematic for me to be calling in spirits with folks that may or may not have experience with that type of work or concept. And sometimes people like get sick after these family constellations. They get like headaches or things that, to me, it's like, oh, it was like a really profound experience, so I'm having a headache. And I'm like, I don't know that. And I'm not saying this happened at our constellations, because I think things were done to open and close things in a really safe and good way. But I have heard of people coming away with what, not, I'm not saying this like from a judgmental perspective, but what might sound like having a spirit attached to a person. Yeah. So it's funny because I stepped away just out of, I guess, like more ethical and for personal reasons, but it was like the thing that people were the most into. And I still sometimes get people reaching out about it. I'm like, well, I'm more than happy to like direct you towards constellation work. But here's why I stepped away. Right.
So does that kind of, this is interesting because I'm totally new to hearing about this. So does that constellation work? Does it always call in like spirits?
So traditionally, I believe, yes. I think traditionally it was mostly ancestrally based.
Right. Yeah. You're going and kind of sitting with the ancestors.
Right. So there are versions of it that don't. There are versions of it that work more with like archetypes and with like I have friends that work with like non-dual perspectives. So they aren't even like calling in specific human individuals. It's more like, we're going to call in the energy of money. And then we're going to do like a constellation around like this person's relationship. But for me, because I do believe that like lineages hold these currents.
Yeah, totally. That's like, exactly what I was going to say.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
For me, it's like, you know, everyone is absolutely welcome to do what they're going to do. And I'm not here to be a gatekeeper for what these healing modalities that people have really beautiful, profound healing experiences around. For me, it's just like the more I sit with the teachers and the lineages I'm learning from, it's like this type of work where people are calling in spirits to inhabit their bodies, possibly. Yeah. That's like initiated priest level type stuff. Like, yeah, we gotta know what we're doing there.
And it doesn't really matter like what I call it. That's one of the funny things. It's like the spirit doesn't care what I call it. If I'm calling the spirit, I'm calling the spirit, you know, like, I mean, there are probably some things that are, you know, better to call a spirit, but like, you know, this, like you're talking about, like taking like a lineage practice and then like stripping off all the language around it and then changing it doesn't change the fact of what it is. Right. Especially like when you take like the reality of spirits as a given, that becomes very much, 'cause you know, I think that happens honestly, just everywhere.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, that whole taking things and stripping it down, it really is this kind of like, is it a result of the Enlightenment? Is it like, you know, and like, even like when working with animals, like, this is a huge thing, like riding that wave of like, is it anthropocentrism? Am I being like too human centric here? Or is it like, because we're coming out of these ideas that animals are just machines and they don't experience emotions, right? And that can also translate to how we relate to the spirit world as well.
Yeah.
And then simultaneously, it's like in the field of animal assisted work, it's like, don't project onto your animals. And yes, that's a huge thing. We sometimes problematically project onto animals, but I'm also a huge advocate for pointing out that social mammals like dogs, like horses, and like the cats that we work with, like, we're all mammals and we have really similar nervous systems, limbic systems. So it's not too far off to believe that we can actually understand what one another are thinking and feeling, right? The fine line between things. So, yeah. I think that was a bit of a tangent because I was going to talk more about that idea of taking things and stripping them down of like the animistic roots of things, right? Which so many of these traditions come from that, like talking about even that overlap of like the hoodoo, conjure, folk traditions and trolldom, right? Like, it's because these traditions are taking certain maybe colonial concepts of Christian wisdom and layering them with these, with the powers that be that exist in the land and that exist in homes and in human culture. So, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes with the very practical purpose of avoiding detection, right? Like being able to work within the, like, the system. Yeah, I think it's definitely, I personally tend to think it's an Enlightenment thing. And you were talking about, like, you know, we're coming off of believing that animals are machines. Hell, we're coming off of believing that we are machines.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I think there is very much, like, it's interesting because I was just talking about this with a friend earlier. I see it as vivisection. Like, we think that we have to, and I say we as in the royal we, because I don't think this way, but you know how it is. Right. We think that in the, especially in like Western, you know, Western conception, we think that we have to take something apart piece by piece and lay it all on the table before we can understand what it is and what it does. But by doing that, especially like a living being, like, you're vivisecting it. And I'm not talking about necessarily doing that literally, even though that has literally happened too, but we do that with ideas as well. And so we think that if we can, you know, and I think it happens with plant medicines too. Like, this idea that, like, if I can distill the most potent form of something, that really means I understand it. When it's like, no, what you did is you just weaponized it, right? And I think that happens across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And that's a tough thing to get out of, because that's like what our very, like I said, like the foundations of how we view our bodies and our spirits, if we even allow those to exist, which a lot of the times it's not even allowed a place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you use the word vivisection, and I think of it as like compartmentalization, like,
totally,
or even like specialization, right? Like, I'm going to study this one field of study and it's going to have like certain vocabulary, and this person over here with this other field of study. And then we won't be able to talk to each other because we have these like weird way lingo that's like, we're talking about the same thing, but we have no idea that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, and that's an interesting
point. Not allowed to say that what we're studying overlaps either. Yeah, it's wild. And I think too, that idea of like humans and animals as machines as well, is like, we then came into that idea of everything being competition biologically, which is not actually a Darwinian thing. It's actually an economic thing. It's like an economist coined the phrase survival of the fittest.
I'm sure that sounds right.
So if we actually, like, if we take a step back and look at the way that the world works, like ecologically, it's so much more about collaboration and interdependence than it is like just competing for whoever's the strongest. So there's that. I think that that's a big part of kind of unlearning the cultural narratives that we've been brought up within.
Yeah, and that can be tough because that can be it was a good thing for me, but at the same time, like it was a lot all at once, and I briefly became kind of almost lost and like, well, if this like so none of this is like how I really think this works. Who the like who am I and where am I? You know what I mean? Like it can be almost like because it's so ingrained in us, it can be almost disorienting when it comes crashing down, right? And I think that's what initiation is, personally. Like I'm stepping through the threshold into a new world, a new way of seeing, a new way of being. And so personally, I wouldn't trade it for the world, but it can be a little dicey, to say the least.
For sure.
So cool. I want to talk a little bit about like your, so have you always kind of thought this way? Or like what was your upbringing like in terms of, you know, how you viewed the world, in terms of what we're talking about? Like, have you always had, or have you had any supernatural experiences growing up or any like watershed moments that make you think like, oh, there's something more to this world and there's something more beyond, you know, what's immediately visible to us? What was your experience with that kind of from a young age?
Yeah, I think, I mentioned earlier growing up outdoors and being in nature, and I think that really, I think for me, my own path being in nature opens the doors to spirit for me. And yeah, I think formative moments, I think there were just so many of them, and they came in different flavors and maybe intensified over time, and then kind of multiplied over time. And I grew up in the South. I grew up within a generally Christian household, and my teenage years, I really had kind of this nature, Christian mysticism, Christian phase that I went through in the South that couldn't really be, I couldn't find a way to like really reconcile the culture around me that identified as Christian because it's very conservative and very different from like my natural studious nature where I'm reading gospels, I'm reading like apologetics, I'm reading theology that just couldn't, I couldn't quite make sense of what was happening. This is like just post 9/11, so there was some pretty wild stuff happening then.
Oh,
So
definitely.
yeah, so that was kind of the beginning, and I think like starting to question that culture in my early 20s, I kind of like rejected that and went down the like I there was a time I was dating a graffiti artist astrologer that introduced me to like the Golden Dawn and was perhaps taking I was taking a bit too much psychedelics and having some pretty intense like psychedelically induced experiences that I had to find a way to get out of. And that really finding the way out was really a way to that I went in deeper because it was like I was having some pretty intense sleep paralysis and night terrors and just like wild stuff happening. And I remember there was a point that I was like, okay, either I'm just going to be insane forever and this is going to continue to happen. Or I'm going to try to do something about it and maybe it'll stop. Right. So I like got all of these books on lucid dreaming and dream work and eventually taught myself to wake up in my dreams and demand that the things that were coming at me leave. And once I was able to get to that point, I was able to go into lucid dreaming and have some like really powerful kind of mystical dreams. And I've always been led by my dreams, like pretty much from that time, maybe a little bit before I started having some pretty intense, like precognitive dreaming experiences and animals coming in my dreams. And really then like books would explain my dream. Like I would like find a book or be reading a book the next day that would like explain what was happening, and ended up just like following these dreams and following these currents of learning that eventually led me to teachers, led me to living in Colorado and working with horses. And then led me to some teachers. So I've had the privilege, I dropped out of university 2 years in, and then about 4 years later went back and ended up studying with two of my mentors, Dr. Lee Irwin and Dr. John Rashford. So Lee is an incredible esotericist. He's a scholar of comparative religion. He's retired now as a professor, but he has some really incredible books. I'll send you like all of his information.
Yeah, that'd
he
be great.
Trained me kind of in the academic scholarship of Western esotericism, as well as the study of Native American religions as well, and really like dreaming experiences. And he and I have kept in touch all of these years later, and I've read some of his more recent books that are just like awesome. So highly recommend him. And I think like that's the thing, is like I had all of these really intense experiences that maybe, you know, like being a millennial on the internet, like things could have gotten maybe a little dicey if I had gone all of the directions that the internet provides for us, right?
Yeah, totally.
But I found teachers. And John Rashford, he is an incredible ethnobotanist, and he's from Jamaica. He was a professor of anthropology and really like gave me a foundation in anthropological theory, in ethnoecology and ethnobotany, looking at how cultures work with plants. And then I lived abroad for 4 years, South Korea, France, and Indonesia, and really like immersed myself in what it was to participate and be a teacher and educator in other cultures. And these are cultures very different from here, especially Asia, like South Korea and Indonesia still have like pretty intact animistic traditions. So like witnessing that, developing relationships with worldviews that like really challenge my own. It's been a wild journey. So yeah, again, like grew up with maybe certain natural proclivities, but it wasn't until I really started through many different phases of development to study and practice in order to like hone those gifts and hone what was happening around me. And yeah, the past few years, big teachers of mine have been plant medicine, particularly ayahuasca and the mestizo lineage out of Peru, Don Jose Campos and Don Gino Chacaruna. I've sat in ceremony with Don Gino quite a few times, and yeah, learned a lot, processed a lot. I've really been integrating those super powerful ceremonies for a few years now. I haven't sat with plant medicine. I don't drink alcohol. I don't sit with really other psychotropic substances. And yeah, talk about some wild, wild magic. Like that's some interesting stuff. And I learned a lot about folk tradition specifically through that lineage of ceremony. And the way that the container is held and the way that ceremony is structured. And being able to like see that in such a profound altered state and come to like the lived experience reality of what's going on when the veil is lifted. Yeah, talk about like, I don't know that I, it's like, I had all these experiences, like, yeah, I'm dreaming things and then they show up in books. But then like, I sit with this within this container, and I'm like, oh shit. Not only is all of this real, like it's way more real than I thought. It feels more real than anything I'm experiencing in day-to-day life. And now what?
Yeah, I love that part. It's like, okay, now I've seen the universe unfold before me and like, you know, have like witnessed past lives and like all this stuff. So how do I go to the grocery store and like get bread? You know, like I gotta fucking live still.
And that's like, that's the thing, but that's what it's about.
Yeah, that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, we're here to go to the grocery store and get bread, man.
We really are. And that's the crazy part. It's like, and I love that you could see that because it's so fascinating to me, like being this like basically immortal spirit made out of light that was like, hey guys, watch, I'm going to go live there. And everyone's like, well, you're going to go live where, dude? You're going to go live there? Why would you do that? And then lo and behold, here we are, you know, and we've come here too. I think really, because for the longest time, my spiritual seeking, and it's, I think it's, it was genuine and I don't regret it. And I don't think it was, there's nothing wrong with it. I think it was just an expression of where I was and what I understood. But it was almost like, I'm looking for this thing over there that's going to explain my experience. That's going to explain maybe how I feel or the experience I'm having, whatever it is. It's over there. And so I'm kind of looking in all these places to find it. And eventually, like, I realized, and you know, going to, like, oh, but you know, what's on, like, the eighth level above all this? Or, like, what's in the dimension beyond what we can see? You know, and, like, fixating on that stuff. But then eventually coming to a point where it's like, oh, I'm actually here to have a human experience, to be incarnate, to be involved in the community that I live in, to be involved, like, on a really... what we call a mundane level, but it's like, that's what the whole thing is. So like, I thought I was being spiritual in all those other realms, and that's cool. It's fine to go there. That's awesome. Right. But like the most spiritual thing I think I can do is, oops, I hit the mic. The most spiritual thing I think I can do is like participate in my life on a day-to-day level, like, and show up in the way that like I'm interested in showing up, which is sometimes difficult because sometimes you're like tired and stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And like all that experience with those other things has actually helped me, you know, access the power to be able to like do the things I want to do today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm so with you. It's huge. And I think that sometimes that can be missed, like having the profound, like, blasting your mind open experiences, like it's so easy to get caught up in like that being the thing that we're supposed to strive for, right? And that's okay if that's where people are at. But yeah, for me, it really has been day to day, even like learning to meet basic needs because life got challenged. I think that there's also like a certain level of like blasting out and being in these spiritual realms, like is also like kind of a privilege because if I'm doing that, then that means that likely most of my basic needs are met. Right.
Yes, so you're like, safe and protected. You're not in a place that's about to be bombed. Yeah,
right,
totally.
Right. Right. So I think for me, you know, the day to day is where it's at. The day to day, bringing the spiritual values and the spiritual insight into every day, like you mentioned, like with building community and building family and building connections and things that are close to home. Like, I think that's so important, and we're really, you know, culturally kind of missing that foundation if we start to strive just for like the big the big spiritual experiences, right? As opposed to like, yeah, the spiritual experience when we go to the grocery store and buy bread.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff you can do with bread. Did you know? There's like
and
all
the,
kinds of
yeah, totally. And you
it
know
is
you
the
can,
body of Christ after all.
Right. You can transmute it into a hanging God, and you can like yeah, do all kinds of cool stuff. Other, you know, you can give it to other spirits, you know.
A whole loaf, all kinds of things we could do with that.
And not only that, but like the it's kind of it's funny what I can take for granted, because the idea that there's even a, and like regardless of what I think about the system and it's like how it's built and what it's built around, regardless of that, the fact that like a bunch of people came together with an idea and created a system that there is even a grocery store where I can buy bread is pretty an impressive testament to like what intention can do, right? That's pretty
True.
wild.
Yeah.
And I can go buy like gushers and like other dumb shit too. Like
I don't know. Gushers is like somebody went up into the realms to,
yeah.
bring them back to us.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you seen their shapes? I mean, come
Yeah,
on.
those are definitely some DMT elf shit. Like, hell yeah. I think, you know, speaking of going to other realms, let's do that a little bit more. The horse in mythology is obviously a very potent symbol, because I think that we've been like relating to these animals for forever. And so to me, the one that comes to mind first, I've got it tattooed on my hand, actually. Can you see that? I don't know if you can.
Not quite, not quite. Okay, yeah. Good. Yep.
Sleipnir, the eight-legged horse of Odin.
Yeah.
And so what Sleipnir's name means slider. And it allows, he allows Odin, it's, he's a journey companion that allows Odin to traverse the realms. Like with the assistance of this horse, he can go between the realms. And there's also the interesting kind of one of the epithets for, I'm going to mispronounce, Yggdrasil is Odin's horse. So like the world tree itself is the horse of Odin. And then there's the pun that like he rides it because he hung on the tree. Yeah. What do you think that is? What do you think? Like, I think there's a potent thing that could be explored there. And we can go into other myths too, where horses might serve a similar, have a similar power, maybe say.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that I can specifically speak on this myth, but I do think like it is, it's almost like almost pan-cultural that the horse is like this vehicle, at least for, yeah, for cultures that ride horses, is a vehicle to travel between worlds. And even this idea in a lot of cultures, like drumming itself is the representation of the horse hooves, right? Of the journey.
Oh, that's
to the
cool.
Yeah.
So is
so,
it often
yeah.
a journey to the underworld that the horse is able to take us on?
Yeah, to I said yeah, other world, I
Oh,
think
other world, sorry.
I think it depends on whatever our conceptions of the worlds
Sure,
are,
we've got
right?
different
Yeah.
layouts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think, you know, a pretty yeah, like one of the oldest would be like Eurasian culture, and specifically like Mongolia, if we look at where the horse was domesticated, like still in that area. The shamans, like, which is the area that world, that word shaman comes from, Mongolia as well. they journey on a spirit horse through drumming and trance. And they are a horse culture. Like everything is kind of centered around the horse because they're nomadic and they, you know, they travel with their gers, which are like the yurts that they go across the plains with their horses and with some other animals that they're, I think, like reindeer and maybe sheep. Anyways, like, yeah, this is like full on still living nomadic horse culture. And the horse is like the vehicle through which this trance and this journeying happens. And it is really interesting to see that you can find that in so many cultures. And yeah, I mean, do horses just show up and take us to the spirit world? Like, I don't know, you know, maybe, possibly. I've had similar experiences like that. But is that because I'm already relating with the horse, or did they just show up? Are they just there waiting for us? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I've had them show up in journeys too. And I don't know if it's a similar thing where it's like, I just always have liked horses. So that makes sense, right? But yeah, there's something so potent there because I think it's really interesting. Like, okay, like the speed at which we're able to move through physical space, it actually like affects our perception, not only of space, but of time. Like we didn't even have the idea of time zones until the airplane was created, because it dilates time so much to be able to move that fast. And then before then, it was like, you know, it would just kind of naturally become the time where you were. So, but you know, the faster you can move, the more you realize that, oh, time is different here, right?
Oh,
like the conditions are different here. Yeah, it's interesting, right? And so like a horse does that too, because a horse allows you to travel way faster than you could by yourself. So you're actually
like, this is so cool. Okay, yeah. So this is making me think about like in like Greek mythology, and even so, like, we'll talk about Helios, right? Like,
yeah.
Him, shout out. Hi, Jack Grail.
Shout out, Helios.
So the four horses of the chariot of Helios, they're actually considered to rule the four quarters of the seasonal year. So when you're talking about time, it just like reminds me of that. Like originally it was like, it was measured by horses, right? It was measured by
yes,
God that rides across the sky with his four horses that are, you know, the equinox and the solstices. And that's so, I think it's so interesting because a lot of my work in really wanting to create this kind of understanding of what it is to have relationship, like reciprocal relationship with horses as beings, is undoing now like contemporary horse culture and that same like mechanization of our minds. Like, so it's interesting that you brought up this concept of time and the way that airplanes, right, or we can think about like automotive vehicles, right, or the original steel horse, which is like the train tracks that came across the world, right, during the Industrial Revolution, and that like that mechanization and the invention of these vehicles took away what may have been a certain relational aspect to getting around the world, right? So when we think of horses, like we think of them as vehicles now, but that's like not how things were. And I, you know, there may have been a certain amount of like perhaps questionable abusive ethics that existed in certain horse cultures historically, but I would imagine like really good horsemanship was relational. Like we have historical records of that, and I don't think they would be put on such a spiritual pedestal if that relationship wasn't sacred historically. So I think it's actually really important when we think about time, when we think about travel, that we remember that like our cultural inheritance as humans was actually like a co-evolution in
Yeah.
collaboration with the horse.
And I think that there's only ever coevolution. Like the idea that like we do it alone is like is a symptom of being out of balance. And in itself contributes to more to a greater level of disharmony, right? Like, because it's like a feedback loop. Like, oh, humans first, and then that creates a system that perpetuates that idea and furthers it and furthers it and furthers it and takes it to the point where it's like literally just destroying the world. Like, not to be, not to get too negative here near the end of the interview, but
But it
I
is.
mean,
So
it
what
is
we're
though. It is
saying
though.
is
100%.
if we hadn't lost our relationship with horses, the world wouldn't be apocalyptic. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I'm saying.
I think you're right though. I mean, I really do. Like, that's a really good point. And I think that that's a really interesting lens through which to look at a lot of the technology that we, and honestly, the way we treat technology too. Like, it's interesting because we treat it as a master-slave relationship. And like for an animist, that's problematic, even with a thing that's considered, quote, I'm using air quotes, inanimate, which is like we know that there's no such thing. That like even ideas I'm in relation to as beings. And so like this idea of like, I mean, it comes back to this concept of like something being its utility as opposed to like a relationship that I'm having with the world around me.
Totally.
Like, how can I extract more labor? Like, really, that's what it is. Like, how can I extract more labor from the situation,
And that's what has been ingrained into us. And I think like, yeah, really, for me, when people ask about, the work that I do in the horse circles, it's like, we're gonna go sit out in nature in the field around horses, and hopefully that's gonna like slowly undo some of what's happening to our nervous systems and some of what's happening to our minds and to our bodies and to our spirits, right? Like,
Yeah, and that brings it around to, that's really cool because that brings it around to the idea of the horse as like the interdimensional journey companion. Like, yeah, like y'all, I want to come out and check it out. Like, so like y'all, yeah, you're sitting in the field with horses, which just in and of itself is fucking cool. Like, I don't really need any more sail. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the sail. Like, that's good. That's the elevator pitch works on me. But also, like, if you really want to take it to what we've been talking about, like the way that that horse, like you said, it like regulates the energy, right? And it might help us regulate like our nervous systems. And in the way that like, so I'm trying to put together this thought and connect these things. Like, so in a way that really is like the horse being, the horse is acting in a shamanic in a shamanic context, right? Like it's transmuting, it's helping me, and we're doing it together, right? But like it's helping the person sitting in the circle with the horse to transmute that energy into maybe a more healing, more constructive form.
Absolutely. And I think that they do that very naturally, and like a lot of it is, it's physiological the ways that they do it. Like you can actually see and observe it on a physical level when it happens. So like in that world of equine assisted therapies and modalities. Like, there's a lot of research coming out about the ways that horses heal us physically, emotionally, and spiritually, right? And so even without necessarily having that spiritual framework, people can show up and find themselves in really profound healing experiences. Yeah. And then, yeah, the spiritual stuff, the shamanic journeying, all of that can be like the cherry on top, right? Or maybe like a little bit more of the advanced work that can happen. And yeah.
Yeah, I like to see it as like, I mean, this is like, I like the cherry on top. It's like that stuff is, it's like extra bonus stuff, you know, like to put it like, to give it like just a really like, but you know what I mean? Like, cause what you're talking about, the physiological effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's all, I mean, honestly, like it's all happening in concert,
mm-hmm.
but like, yeah, you have really concrete stuff happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there also may be like some really wild spiritual shit happening too, but like
mm-hmm.
you don't even have to experience that for it to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I guess I didn't really speak to this much, but this is like the whole reason my project is called Wild Horse Circle is because I have for the past 6 years, I adopted a Mustang from the Bureau of Land Management from the federal government. So I adopted a wild horse. Mustang is just the word for the wild horses of the Americas. So at any point, usually there are about 50,000 wild horses that have been taken off the public lands designated to them, and they are in government holding facilities. So they're basically in these like overcrowded corrals.
Wait, and, so there's horse jails basically?
Yeah. And my horse actually came from a horse jail that was connected to an actual human prison as well, where they have like a program where prisoners actually, it's kind of like a equine therapy rehabilitation work where the prisoners gentle the Mustangs, like they train them and get them ready for adoption. So that's actually like kind of cool.
Yeah, that's kind cool.
Of horse and human prisons like just didn't exist, but
right. Yeah, that'd be better.
But so yes, they are like horse prisons. There are many different players at stake in the world of public lands. So I know a lot and I have my own opinions, but I really believe like my work has been to create change at the level of getting these horses adopted. So that's like really education around that is the most important thing. And I've kind of stepped away from like being super political about what my idea of herd management is. People are more than welcome to reach out to me and I can talk to people about my opinions. But my horse Rogue came from a government holding facility and I adopted her and with help from other Mustang trainers, got her like ready to live a life with humans, right? And we call that domestic life, right? There's like domestic and wild, but
right.
I really like the ways that those two things come together. Because if we think about wild, we might think about the word ecology and eco, the Greek word for eco, right? Like ecology, ecocentric, like eco soaps, all of that. It comes from the Greek word oikos, which means home. So if we're really thinking about it, like we've said, like all of this stuff is connected. There's no separation. We have this idea that like domestic life, the life of the home, right, is somehow separate from the wild. But in reality, it overlaps.
Yeah, there's no, it's totally an arbitrary distinction completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And the wild,
artificial.
Yeah. They have developed over time certain characteristics that like quote air quotes domestic horses don't exhibit because they've adapted to survive in the wild. So they have a certain level of like resiliency, and they're really sharp, they're really quick, they're really smart, they have a hardiness to survive in the wild. So that actually is, some of those themes come into the horse circles, because right now Rogue, she's the only Mustang that's part of the herd that I work with here in the San Luis Valley, but in the past worked with a bunch of other Mustangs as well. So this idea of like, what does it mean to like interact with these previously wild animals, and what aspects of our wild selves can we call upon? What aspects of these like instinctual natures that we may have lost touch with can be called upon when we're sharing and in relationship with these animals and with the outdoors?
I like it. Really well put. Yeah, I want to go back a little bit to like talk some about that artificial distinction between wild and domesticated. Because I think that's happens not only in that area, but again, like in the West, we do that to everything, right? And there's this idea of like, okay, we're here, and then there's this wall we built, and then over there's that other stuff. And honestly, that happens in a very real physical sense, like with literal walls. But we're always kind of separating off the other from what we're here doing. There's us, and then there's the other. And I think that's absolutely what has been done with, and I just call it materialism. I don't know what else to call it, but the over, maybe it's like the over emphasis on materialism as like materialist reductivism, right? Like that's all there is. You know, it's kind of like, here's the world of the material and here's the concrete and then what we can see. And it's like a pretty machiney. And then on the other side is like all these spirits and all this, these ideas that don't fit in with that, this artificial world that we've built, but really like you can't keep it out. And so like, I mean, personally, what I think is happening is that those barriers are dissolving right now. And so I'm very actually optimistic about that, because I think we can see it, that that's something that's very much, the idea of spirit and the reality of spirit and like the reality of our relationship to spirit, I think is like, it's much more, I see it as much more acceptable and common than it was like when I was growing up, you know? So I'm hopeful there. And so maybe that's going to happen too, you know, with this artificial distinction between wild and domestic. I think it's probably, it all goes hand in hand, right?
I think, yeah, I think that's a really good point. And yeah, I would agree, especially like, yeah, that idea of like the separation of spirit or spirits. And, you know, I think maybe there is like a bit of a romanticization around like animals and plants being the doorway to spirit, because they are, right? Like they're living in the present moment. They're living kind of... They're connected, and we humans sometimes have a hard time tapping into that deeper well of connections. And also, like, if we really are taking on this framework that everything's inspirited, then again, there is no distinction between my domestic house with a, you know, a laptop computer and a cell phone. Like all of these traditions that have developed over time that believe that the world is inspirited, it's in like everything. There aren't inanimate objects, right? And we can communicate with the spirits. We can wake them up and we can have relationship with them. And yeah, it's a pretty wild framework. And I think it's also a long journey of unlearning, because, you know, even as we have said in this conversation, like we've referred to things and we've had to like step back a couple times and be like, but everything is spirit also, like talking
yeah, it's
about
tough.
Like, this is problematic, and also this is like a part of it and not separate.
I think our language is based around it. Like the English language is based around it, is based around those ideas. And so it makes it actually really difficult to even talk about. Yeah. And like you said, unlearning, like that's some real, like, I don't think I can do that without spirits. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I can't. To me, like, you know, it's funny because you talk about like we see the animals and plants as the gateway to spirit. Like, honestly, we often see it like we're here throwing them a bone and helping them out or whatever. Like, oh, yeah, she's come be more civilized with us. But honestly, like they're here helping us out. Like we would be so screwed, you know, without them. So with that in mind, what do you, okay, this might be a big question, so forgive me, but what do you think is the number one thing that the human world today can learn from the horse world?
This the thing is that this might sound like not very horse-like, because we have lots of stories around horses, but I would say slowing down.
I love that. I love that. I love I love a paradox.
Yeah, and of course it's not very horse-like, because we think of horses like galloping through the field, right? But like they're not doing that most of the time. they're actually like pretty grounded and pretty present, and yeah, like I think that's kind of the main thing is like the regulation of the nervous system, slowing down, being present. I think that really is the gift that horses offer to us, so that we can be ready to freaking go when we're ready, right?
Yeah, right. Like you said, like if like I can't look within and I can't like journey to these other realms if my my immediate physical needs aren't met. And sometimes that does require slowing down, like, yeah, so that I can deal with the fast times, not the fast times at Ridgemont High, but just like, you know, the fast times. that's immediately what it made me think of. That's good. I like that a lot. And then also, like, even after I said it, talking about like the inadequacies of language, I immediately thought, well, they would also probably tell me that there's no difference between the human world and the horse world, that they're the same, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're a little different. I think, yeah, I think there's some fun differences, and I think that that's what makes like connecting across species so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always something to learn, they have something to teach me, right? I see it with every, like, I think everyone that comes into our lives has something to teach us. And I prefer that attitude too, because it really helps me to be open and curious and accepting of other ideas. So it's like you coming on here, like to me, I see it as like you're teaching me. I'm lucky to be able to do this, you know? So I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me. Do you want to quick tell people like all the social media where they can find you, website stuff, like all that good stuff, where they can, you know, reach out to you and learn more about Wild
Absolutely.
Horse Circle?
Yeah, I kind of mentioned earlier, I've been on about a year-long hiatus from being out and about in the public, but best ways to reach me would be, I'm at wild.horse.circle on both TikTok and Instagram. And then I also have a personal Jamie Instagram, and that's at where are the big people? And so those are probably the best places. And yeah, who knows? In the future, there might be a website up, there's a domain and things in the works, but I've slowed down. I've taken the
Hey, that's
horses
good.
away.
Yeah,
I'm
hell
coming
yeah.
slow. Yeah.
Yeah, like it. I mean, probably the best place they can find you is out there in the field with the horses, right?
Right. Just take a look out here in the valley.
Out there, you're out there
Down there.
yonder.
Find the ponies and I'll be close by.
Okay, one more question. Okay, I just remembered this. What is your relationship with dogs now?
Oh yeah. Well, I have a dog and he's like the best buddy. No, I love dogs. I love wolves. I had like a short period of time that some domestic wolves were in my life. I love canines. I think that I actually did a lot of dream work with like wolves and dogs like during the time things got kind of dark and scary. So I don't think it's really like a lived fear that I like carry around with me consciously. I think it's probably still there unconsciously because I actually got bit by a dog like a week ago.
Oh, really?
It was a black
No
dog too.
kidding.
Yeah, and I
Wow.
got like it like broke the skin and I bled a little bit, but we knew it might have happened, So I will say like understanding horse behavior has also transferred into me understanding dog behavior and also understanding the ways that like trauma impacts humans, horses, and dogs, and the ways that that plays out in their behavior. And shout out to my golden retriever boy, Reality, who I live with. He's a really unique dog and had a good bit of maybe puppy trauma growing up. So he's like my teacher in a big way because he's not like, oh, I've got like the dog training thing down. I know what I'm doing. And then this dog comes into my life and I'm like, actually, I don't. And all of my buttons are being pushed and everything I thought that I knew to be consistent about is like flipped on its head.
That's the
And
best. Those are the best times.
yeah, I love it. So I'm learning. One of my greatest teachers is currently a dog.
Yeah, that's why I asked because I had a feeling that was the case. Because I think that that's what happens, like I said, like our fears, like the things we fear as kids, it's like, okay, I have business with that thing. And sometimes that can be, that's the way it sometimes pops up. Like there's a, because I find that the things I'm afraid of kind of also fascinate me.
Oh, yeah.
And I
Yeah.
can't, I'm almost obsessed with them. Like when I
For
was a
sure.
kid, like I was afraid of aliens, but I couldn't stop reading about aliens and looking at shows about aliens and like finding all the information I could about them. That's just interesting.
No, absolutely. I think, yeah, like, and I think even at the time that I would have been being told that scary story, they're like, it's layered with the experience of scary things and positive things. Because one of my
Yeah,
childhood
totally.
dogs was like attacked by doves. And then when I grew up on the farm with horses, there was literally in South Carolina a pack of like 30 wild dogs that lived in the woods that would like come onto our property and try to attack whoever was there, including our dog. So it was like a legitimate fear too. And it's a legitimate biological fear as well to like be afraid of predators. So that's something that I still sit with. And it's like, I don't think we have to, I actually think it would be, it might not be wise to let go of that fear completely if it is a
Yeah.
legitimate, if predators still exist.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think sometimes it's a healthy respect, right? Like a fear,
Totally.
right? Like there's certain beings that I'm like, I'm not gonna just call them up for no reason.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I have a
Yeah.
healthy fear and respect for this being. Like some of those beings are people. It's been so fun talking to you, Janie. Thank you so much for coming on.
You are so welcome.
And I really appreciate it. It was a blast. I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been so fun. You too.
Do you experience weird shit? Do your parents not like to tell their friends about what you do in the woods? Do you make more friends in a graveyard than you do at a party populated by living humans? Do you have interactions with beings that are not strictly considered human? Do other people look at you like you're crazy when you mention talking to trees in casual conversation? If you fist pumped or even just answered yes to any of these questions, you may be a nightbird. So let's sing together. If you'd like to come on the show and flap your gums with me, share your stories, or just talk about the malleable nature of reality for a while, then send me an email at tim@nightbirdpodcast.com. That's tim@nightbirdpodcast.com. I'd love to have you on the show. But until then, I gotta fly. But before I go, let me say this. Remember, you are never alone. I believe you.